Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Another episode of the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast starts now as part of the Sports History Network, and pleased to have another set of authors, yes, authors this time, on the podcast, as we've interviewed numerous authors in the past, whether it was stories about George Allen or stories about when the DeMar Hamlin situation happened. We had an author on that was actually a newspaper writer at the time for that spoke about a similar case back in the 60s and 70s. But a topic that I know I've discussed here before when it comes to an interesting old topic in the NFL that maybe needs a little bit more light shined upon it. And that's the story of Leo Lyons, the Rochester Jeffersons and the birth of the NFL. That is the name of the book, and the author's are Jeffrey J. Miller and John D. Steffenhagen. Yes, we gave middle initials and everything here, and we're pleased to have both of them join us on the podcast. Boys, thanks for joining us, and can't wait to dive more into this book.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. John, let's start with you, because I know this is a near and dear thing to your heart, and I know the Western New York faction of the Pro Football Researchers Association, thanks to the work of Jeff, is very close, very tight-knit, and you guys oftentimes work together on things. But for people that don't know, explain why this is such a passion project for you.
Just because of the fact that I knew him as a little kid and knew he was involved in football, but didn't know, you know, the extent, and it took decades and decades before I finally delved into the boxes that I had received from my mom, who received them from Leo. And that's what kind of got everything going over the years. And working with Jeff, Jeff and Ken Crippen were the two that I got a hold of way back 20 years ago. Just wanted to start digging in and say, you know, I've never heard of the guy Leo Lyons as far as football. And they're like, oh, yeah, with the Rochester Jeffersons. And it's been a discovery for myself, for Jeff. It was for a lot. And it's because of the relatives who have been digging through their houses, finding things in attics, that it's really shed a light on things that no one's ever seen before.
Well, and Leo, of course, was your grandfather, correct?
Great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather. Okay, so really deep lineage there and deep into the, I guess, original NFL and a lot of stories. And Jeff, for you, I know you've written a number of books before this. You've researched a number of topics. Your, you know, experience in this is vast. What made Leo Lyons an interesting topic for you, and why pick this opposed to doing something else at this point in your life?
Well, I had written several books on the Buffalo Bills, and I figure, you know, until they win a Super Bowl, there's really not much more to say about them at this point. But I've always loved the leather helmet era of football. I've written a book about Pop Warner. I've written a book about the Buffalo All-Americans. which is really how John and I met. So John had asked me a long time ago to help him write this book, but because I was writing about the Bills, I kind of put it off. But the more I learned about Leo, and talking to John and really feeling his passion, it really just kind of rubbed off on me. And it got to a point where I saw enough where I thought, this is a story that's really been lost and really needs to be told. And I felt that I really wanted to be the one to bring it out. I wanted to be the one to tell it. Thankfully, John hadn't found someone to partner with yet, when he asked me again. And I just felt the time was right. It was time. And, I see a lot of talk about other people from the pre and early NFL years being talked about for the Hall of Fame. And I don't know if Leo belongs in the Hall of Fame or not. I like to believe that he does, but maybe if his story being told is what gets him over the top, then I think I'm the one to tell it.
John, you mentioned in the book, Jeff, you mentioned in the book that, you inherited this box of materials, which I know you indicate in the preface that didn't mean a whole lot to you for a long, long time. And then you started getting a passion for football and started getting into it. Can you talk about, I know the other thing you mentioned in the book that I thought was really interesting was that Leo was a voracious note taker, and not only voracious, but very, very, very detailed in everything he did in his life. Can you talk about the process of the sort of the research process to get to the book?
Yeah, it was a situation where Joe Horgan, it was actually his first year in 1976 at the Hall of Fame. And upon Leo's death, my great-grandmother, unbeknownst to all the family, told Joe to come and load up the truck, take everything we got. It's probably what he would have wanted. So in the meantime, before they got there, my mom and some aunts and uncles had gone over to the house and were just starting to pick up things that they could, like some of the, just to have some items from him. And so those items are the items that I have now. And there were, when I say there wasn't just a box, there was five or six boxes originally, the big banana box ones. From then, and they were just stuffed full of documents. And back when I was in high school, it was 85, you couldn't just Google it. I'd see names, and I see Lombardi, Halas. I'm like, oh, that's cool, he must have been with the old guys. But back in the 80s, you really didn't know, and I wasn't a football fan, I was a racing fan because my father was a race car driver. So yeah, and over the years, I'd take things out and then be like, oh, wow. But then there was so much and all over the place, and I didn't know anything about football history. So I would always just kind of give up. And, I even got made fun at school because there was a show and tell once. I had brought pictures in of Leo with George Halas, Vince Lombardi, all these guys. And they're like, it's not your great-grandfather. Like, you'd be rich by now. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'd be rich by now. And so it almost kind of wore on me after a while. No one believed me. And I'm like, all right. So I just put the stuff back in the boxes and forgot about it. So they sat in my closets for 40 years, basically. And at times I would take stuff out periodically, look at it. Some of them had antiques in it. There was one that was the Johnson & Johnson first aid box. I don't know if you've seen that. Sometimes I brought it to the meetings. Yeah. But I just thought I thought the items in these boxes were just Leo's from the Jeffersons. So that thing, I put it in my garage. It sat in there for 20 years, got paint on it. It's been dented, got some rust on it. I just thought they were antiques. So without any other identification, I had no idea of knowing. So then finally, well, over the years prior to that, or during that time, I contacted Jeff, I contacted Ken Crippen, and that's how it started, my involvement with the PFRA, and talked to more people. But so that led to that. So Yeah, so it just started to evolve, but it wasn't until my aunts and uncles started to pass away that they were either moving or something like that. They would come across stuff. And my one aunt who shed more light, he suffered from dementia. He admitted that he never wore a helmet during his football career. So he was really struggling, probably even the 1960s and 1970s. So he was hiding stuff in things because we would find photo albums with the family, and then they would find documents and programs in there. We're like, why would they be in there? And again, we're like, maybe, you know, I'm always speculating that he was paranoid or something. But anyways, the one program, there was a one from 1963, and it had Leo on the center of the field, the coin toss. And inside this program fell out an inventory list that was attached to a Pete Rozelle memo asking for Leo or an inventory list for the opening of the Hall of Fame. And on this list were things that I had, not all. I mean, there was a Red Grange uniform from 1925 was listed on here. And so, I mean, it was a shocking how much stuff was on there I didn't have. So whatever happened to that, it could get thrown away or gone to the Hall of Fame. But so this led me on this expedition. So then once I had all this stuff, I mean, like I say, there's thousands of documents and just notes. He put notes on Saturday Evening Post. My mother would tell me that she got in trouble when she was a little kid because she would be over to Leo's house and there were stacks of magazines under this table. And one time she took it for a show or a thing where you'd cut out pictures out of the magazine and for some project or something. Well, I guess one day she went in there and was cutting a picture of something out of it. And he flipped out. He's like, oh, my God, no, not my magazines. And so she goes, I remember there was a lot of writing on them, like handwriting. And so they were like, so now to find out, we have these pages. That's where he was actually writing notes down, we think, on his train rides to and from the football games out west, talking about, you know, the game. So, yeah, he put notes on everything, magazine covers. But he would keep them, but it was extremely difficult to sort through everything and chronicle them in chronological order. So, yes.
Yeah, I was listening to a couple of the other interviews that you two have done recently, and one of the things, Jeff, that you said really struck me when you look at Leo's story, and that's that you referred to him as sort of the Forrest Gump of football. The thing that caught me was that I think you guys have uncovered something that a lot of people obviously don't know about, and that's what Leo's place is in the history of the game. And I was reminded of one of my favorite John movies, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, where at the end they say, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. But I think what you guys have done is you guys have printed the facts, because Leo, which I don't think a lot of people know, touched and was a pioneer in a number of different areas that I don't think a lot of people know about. Can you guys go into some of the things that he actually pioneered?
Sure. And kudos for referencing my favorite John Wayne movie, by the way. I'm a big fan of that movie.
Jeff, between the three of, or the four of us, he tries to reference that movie in every podcast that we do. So far, listenership is below the age of probably 60. They've never heard of it before. Luckily, yeah. I'm his son, so I have. Carry on.
Well, I think it starts, you know, I mean, going through the four. Let's just go with the Forrest Gump experience here. You know, it starts in 1912 when, you know, he comes across an opponent who happens to be Haitian American, but black. And he recruits him and hires him to play for the Jeffersons. That's 1912. That's Henry McDonald. He's the fourth known black professional football player in the nation. And then a few years later, 1915, he creates the first recognizable logo that's used by a professional football team. The Jeff's script logo was the first logo ever. And then a year after that, 1916, he starts talking about football cards. And this is before the National Football League has even started. He's thinking of ways to promote professional football, not just a league, but, you know, he or just a game of football itself. So he's thinking, I'll get guys like Jim Thorpe and Charlie Brickley to go in on this. You know, he tries to sell it to Wrigley and to George Eastman. You know, the Kodak company is right there in Rochester. He tries to get these people to partner with him. He gets a little interest, but he gets rebuffed in the end. But in 1916 is also the year that he brings in Walter Camp, who's the godfather of American football, to preside over the decision of the New York State Championship which the state championship was a big deal in those days, and to get Walter Camp to decide the outcome was a big deal. 1917, he challenges Jim Thorpe to a game, the Canton Bulldogs, and, you know, the Jeffersons are state champions, but the Canton Bulldogs are a powerhouse. The Jeffersons go out there and get their butts kicked, but he becomes friends with Thorpe, and then, you know, he says, you know, I'm thinking we should have a football league, a national league. And Thorpe tells him, well, we're talking about it out here in Ohio. We'll let you know when this happens. Well, 1920 rolls around. You know, Leo's there to help form the National Football League. He's there along with George Halas and Carl Stork and Frank Need, all those guys to birth the NFL. Then he also has his own, you know, he has a franchise. He's a founding, they're a charter member of the National Football League. 1925, he tries to sign Red Grange. It's well documented in the book. John has all he's got the canceled check and all the documents and all of Leo's notes about his efforts to sign Red Grange. So, I mean, if you go through, he just seems to come into contact with everybody. You know, there's notes about Curly Lambeau. There's notes about George Halas. There's notes about Pete Rozelle and Burt Bell and Joe Carr. It just goes on and on and on. He came into contact with everybody. So truly a Forrest Gump type of individual.
John Stephen Hagen and Jeff Miller are guests, authors of the book about Leo Lyons, which is Leo Lyons, the Rochester Jeffersons, and the birth of the NFL. Guys, I was just leafing through it while we're talking here, and I immediately went to the chapter that said that he almost went broke however many times. I think it says, I nearly went broke a half dozen times. And I was drawn to that because obviously you think of a guy that's touched all the things that he did, and you'd think that, you know, there would come to a point in his life where financial stability would become a thing pretty quickly. And the one thing that stood out to me in the chapter was that he apparently almost thought about bootlegging at one point.
He actually did.
Yeah. For both of you. I mean, John, I mean, obviously, you know, being your great grandfather, 18th Amendment at the times, which had created prohibition. I mean, very long ago, over 100 years ago, but just knowing that, you know, one of these guys that's like kind of become this mythical type figure within the NFL, that he was going to those lengths when now there's so much money in the NFL that, you know, it doesn't seem to matter. What does that say about the early NFL, and what did that say about his love of the game too?
You know, it's ironic because even after this book is out now, today I was just on newspapers.com and going through different newspapers in Canton and different places like that. And it was from 1922. And it says, most of the owners today are thinking about throwing in the towel. That was 1922. And Ralph Hayes' name came up first. And he goes, yeah, he goes, we got a good team. I go, but there's just the people just are not into it. They just love the college game. And he was saying, I might have to next year just go back to selling cars. And so I got a chuckle out of it. I'm like, I'm still learning, because Leo, it was like never a thought that he wasn't going to succeed. He, you know, all lanes, when he tried to sign Red Grange, he would put in notes afterwards, like, I knew this wasn't going to work, but I had to do it. I have everything invested my whole life. And he dealt with the mafia. That was how he got the money from the That was a absolutely like a movie that played out, because I called Jeff, though I was like really late, because I said I found a bunch of stuff, but and it's in a box, and it was a big wad of paper, you know, it had all gotten wet and it was old and it was brittle. It was basically just, you know, coming apart in pieces. And I go, there's a check in there. I see a check, a yellow check. And it looks like it says ANGE, like Grange. I'm like, what are the odds that it would be that? I'm like, I mean, he's got millions of documents. So there was a lot of other checks as well. And I'm like, I want to get it apart. I go, but I'm afraid I'm gonna once you got, one shot, they're gonna damage it. So he's like, don't touch it here, you know, research it. So I actually called the Smithsonian for a bunch of things that I have. And I'm like, you know, how do I get this apart? And they're like, you've got to take it and you've got to freeze it for several days. Just put it in there. Don't wet it. But just put it in there and freeze it. And then take it out. And then carefully, with dental picks, kind of just pick away at it, at a layer at a time. Like if you find an edge, and then you slowly just like weasel the thing in there, like a Q-tip. It was like, it took forever. So he's on the other line and I'm like, I think it says Harold Red Grange on the check. And he's like, I remember he was nervous. I can't remember now what we were saying, but I was a wreck. I was on my wife. I'm like, what if I just rip this thing and tear it apart and you can't even read the name on it? I'm like, I remember I did it. It took another day. I'm like, I can't do this. I'm like, I don't know what to do. But anyways, we got it apart and there was the check. And not only was there the check, I mean, there was various ones to Joe Carr and stuff for the membership fee every year. But there was the bank statement on the back of that check to Grange. So I'm like, come on. I'm like, that one, I didn't think I was going to get apart. It's got holes in it, but I got it apart enough to see the name. He put $5,000 in the bank account the week before he went to go get Grange. And it says Boscarino in the ledger. So I'm like, well, who's Boscarino? So now, thank God, newspapers.com, because there's no way. I'm like, it would take years to research who Boscarino is. Come to find out, it was Rochester's mafia guy in 1925, and he was indicted for all kinds of stuff. So he was dealing with the mob. That was always the family rumor anyway, because he knew a lot of big mobsters in Rochester. But things like that, it's just mind-boggling. It's been the craziest 4 or 5 years going through this stuff. I go off on a tangent. There's so much. I remember whenever I get to the PFRA meetings, my head has got like 50 stories in there. They're rolling, and I start going off, and I'm like, reel me back, because I get so excited. But how can you not? If you like football history, I mean, it's like, this is, it's just crazy.
I love the Boscarino story only because if there's something I like almost as much as football history, it's mob history. I probably have as many mob history books at home as I do football history books. So,
oh my gosh. Anyway,
I love this story. You said something too, which I think is really interesting. You said that you're researching newspapers.com just recently. You're continuing to research this, even though you've written the book, you're still digging.
We just found out that Leo, well, no, we did mention in the book. I just got that out before we went to print, was that Leo's daughter was the co-founder of St. John Fisher College, where the Buffalo Bills practice. I'm like, wait a minute. Leo is from Pittsburgh, New York, where St. John Fisher is. So here you got the founder of the NFL and the founder of the college that the Bills are playing at. It's like, it never ends. And it's like, her story was like a storybook thing. She was young. She died of leukemia. She was in 1940. She's a woman as a founder of a men's college, which was unheard of. People from around the country were talking about praising her for being like this, you know, incredible thing. It never ends. I mean, I laugh when I watch movies and stuff. I'm like, there's no depth. I'm like, good Lord. I mean, this thing is, his life is just nonstop from a kid to when he died.
Yeah. This story itself, I mean, I know that you brought up and said that you don't know if he deserves a place in Canton. I know John's feelings on this because I've talked to him before about it, and I know that it's his great grandfather. So I know that, you know, obviously anybody, if there was a chance for me to see one of my relatives in a Hall of Fame of any sort, yeah, I would want that as well.
Sure.
But for someone who's purely been in the research chair of this, make the case, why should Leo Lyons be in the Hall of Fame? Is he as important as any founding member of the NFL?
Yeah, I believe that he is in a lot of ways. You know, when you're starting with the integration of the game, you know, he was a pioneer in the integration of the game, and I think that that's huge. And then having the first logo, then trying to get football cards. I mean, he pushed football cards for 20 years before they finally started. It was his idea. Being a founding father of the league. The other thing that people don't realize is he was also the idea of the Pro Football Hall of Fame was Leo's. When the when baseball was putting together their Hall of Fame in 1936, Leo was actually collecting stuff before that. But there's a letter from Joe Carr where he writes to Leo and he says, I love your idea about a museum for professional football like the baseball has, but we just don't have the money yet. So, I mean, when you look through everything that he did over the course of his career, you know, and then I look and I don't mean to disrespect anybody, you know, because, you know, I think anybody who gets in a Hall of Fame, you know, God bless them. I think it's great. But I know a lot of people are pushing for Ralph Hay right now. But I, you know, Ralph Hay was only the owner of the Canton Bulldogs for like 4 or 5 years. And, you know, he bought the team. They were already successful. He held the meeting. And that was about really the extent of his, you know, accomplishments. Leo just did all these things. He, you know, they were all firsts or they're all, you know, something that he did that, you know, were just ahead of his time. So I truly believe that if there's a forgotten person from that era, you know, maybe, you know, there's a couple of other people I could think of, Peggy Parrott or Carl Stork or something like that. But I still think Leo is the number one guy that's forgotten from the early or pre NFL era that belongs.
Especially astonishingly, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but
ahead,
yeah, like
ahead,
the things we found from the Wilson company where Leo, before the Bears game, is meeting with George Halas and writes down on a piece of cardboard thing that was actually from the Wilson company where they were testing the football that they were experimenting with. And he writes down, like Jeff said, it was like a pregame warm-up. And here he is writing Sternemann, Halas.
Like a skill competition, yeah.
Yeah, a skill competition where he got pass, catch, kick, you know, and he's putting what they were comparing the Spalding football with the Wilson football. And, I mean, that right there, it's like this guy was – Leo was always working to improve the game. And that's why George Halas and Art Rooney were his best friends – and who constantly said, Leo is this guy who just is always in the background, but no man was ever as dedicated as Leo ever. And in Bob Carroll, the historian who hated Leo because Leo would lecture him because Leo was getting old and, you know, Bob Carroll wasn't an NFL player. So, you know, he would try to school him and Leo was in the wrong totally because he was not a scholar. And so, you know, it would go back and forth, but yeah. But Bob Carroll admitted and wrote that if it was on the love of the game, the dedication, the lifelong stuff, he would have been the charter member of the Hall of Fame. He would have been the first guy in.
And one other thing that blew me away in the book was he came up with the original concept for the shield, the NFL shield.
Yeah.
And you guys, you have some drawings in there that he did, which is just amazing to me.
That'd be like that. I mean, him saying that would be like Jerry West, the logo of the NBA not being in the Basketball Hall of Fame. I mean, right?
Exactly.
Like that's, I mean, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Not only does he have it in there, he explains how he came up with it. You know, it says Jim Thorpe's Olympic. I don't remember what it said, but something about that it was the emblem on his shirt.
From the Olympic.
You go back and look at the pictures from 1912, and there's Jim Thorpe with the shield, with the stars and stripes. And of course, Leo put Major League Football. He didn't want NFL. He wanted MLB. But that's still pretty darn good to, you know, be a teenager.
I wanted to indicate for people that are interested, I think the book is available through McFarlane and also Amazon.
Correct, yes.
And also, I just wanted to point out some of the great things that are in the book. There's great photos in the book. There's a chronological history of Leo and the Jeffersons and his place in football. There's a marvelous appendix in the book, one with photos from Leo's collection, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
There's also a player register for the Jeffersons and also the records of the Jeffersons. The appendix alone are worth the purchase price. It's just a marvelously, I think, illustrated book. Just so many things that you guys pulled together and put into the book in addition to the narrative.
Yeah, George, I wanted it to be like the definitive book, you know, so you weren't, I'm sure people could come up with questions, but I wanted to make sure that we were answering every question and pinpointing every important fact about Leo. And I think we covered every base, but, you know, again, you know, John's constantly, he's still researching to this day and he will never stop. So I'm sure we missed something along the way, but thank you for that. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say there were so many stories that we didn't put in the book because me and Jeff would go back and forth, you know, because it was always tough to border on, am I being a homer or am I being, you know, I'm reading this out of the newspaper, but, and obviously we never took things that he wrote in his notes that sounded kind of, you know, far-fetched or something. We never used those. They had to be backed up by
unless we could prove it. Yeah, unless we could find something to prove it.
And they get frustrating a lot. There were so many times something he wrote in there and I felt it was so important. And Jeff's like, we can't put it in there because Leo could just be saying it. Maybe he wrote it after it happened, you know? So he's like, no, we got to look back. We got to go and look at the people. And it was painstaking. And I don't know how many times he drove me. I was going to quit. I'm like, I can't do this. I'm like, I'm spending day and night researching. And he'll throw back to me, that's not good enough. And I'm like, come on, that you got all this information. And now he's stuck to his guns. And I'm so glad that he did.
Yeah, last kind of thought for you guys and maybe get both your thoughts on this. You know, when you think of music, oftentimes people talk about the influence that the Beatles have had, but not really knowing that the Beatles' influence was like Buddy Holly, because Buddy Holly passed away so soon in his life. I feel like when everybody talks about the NFL, they talk about Pete Rozelle, they talk about George Halas, they talk about you know, Jim Thorpe, they talk about everybody but Leo Lyons.
Right.
Why did Leo Lyons get skipped over when Pete Rozelle bought him a license plate that said NFL One? Why did this guy get skipped over when all of these other guys are like giants in the game?
Well, let me go first, and because, you know, John should have the last word on that, but kudos again for a Beatles reference now, because, you know, John Wayne and the Beatles are diametrically opposed, but I grew up loving both of them. So beautiful. Love it. But, Leo, I think, was forgotten because, you know, the Jeffersons died in 1925. And then, you know, he was kind of, even though he was at all the league meetings and he would, you know, he was made the honorary historian, which is another reason why maybe he belongs in the Hall of Fame. He was the first league historian. He was always there, but it was always George Halas, Art Rooney, the Maras, you know, George Preston Marshall, et cetera, you know, Dan Reeves. It was never, you know, Leo Lyons was a forgotten guy. I mean, how many people remember who owned the Buffalo All-Americans or the Pottsville Maroons? You know, very few. So, you know, that was Leo's fate. And I think, you know, he thought maybe there was some role that he would play in the NFL if that was the executive director of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, which never happened, but maybe that would have sealed his legacy, but that never happened. But I think that I'm hoping this book changes that. So John, I don't know how you feel, but go right ahead.
I'm finding more as I research, like, say, I've been doing kind of Rolf Hay lately, but kind of looking into his life and what, you know, he was a great car salesman, the Hubmobile. I found some rare pictures in a couple of newspapers of the Hubmobile showroom. There hasn't been many photos. I don't know if you guys know, George and John, but there isn't a lot of photos of that car dealership. And I did find some today, actually. But just finding out that these guys, again, weren't involved with the NFL like Leo was. It was being a kid and being obsessed with it from, you know, 16 years old. He was obsessed with starting a league. And all the way to his last, you know, days where he was kicked out of meetings. And here's a picture of him with a janitor in the hallway. Leo has a big display up in the hallway of the meeting, you know, and he's not allowed in. And he loved it so much that it was an obsession, and it was sad, really. I mean, we didn't even put that in the book that, you know, I see these pictures and he looks so sad. I mean, I think he literally was like married to the NFL. And so I mean, if they got to make him the fan award, that's becoming this big thing. You know, maybe he's the biggest fan, but that seems cheap. So I don't know. I do believe he should be in the Hall of Fame. I know other interviews I've said no, but I don't want to. Until Jeff was like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, I don't want to be the homer. You know, it's like I see Joe Carr's, his son or grandson, and he's, oh, yes, everything's Rolf Hay. And I'm like, I don't want to be like that and say, oh, yeah, he deserves it. But as I go and seriously delve, I'm spending my lifetime researching these other guys. It's like, I cannot find another guy that's as dedicated as Leo. And, you know, it's kind of sad how he just was pushed aside because he was quiet early on. And then when he was old, I think he was resentful and he pissed a lot of people off. And we could see it in memos with Pete Rozelle, which I have a stack of. And, you know, he was just a bitter old man at the end and he lost a lot of favor with people.
Yeah, I not to denigrate, you know, anybody like you said, Jeff, you know, I know a lot of people, myself included, you know, I believe Rolf Hay should be in, but by the same token, Leo should be in. I mean, if we're going to put in, you know, the modern owners, like the Bartolos and the Jerry Jones and all of these guys who, you know, I understand they own teams that did great things, but if we're going to put them in and then you have somebody who is a true pioneer, you know, it just goes without saying. It's one of those things where it's a name that has just fallen through the cracks. And I hope the book brings this to the attention of the powers that be, because I will go on saying that he's very deserving of a place in Canton.
Even Ken Crippett had told me, because I wasn't aware, that Dan Rooney said that he asked him point blank, Ken asked or Dan Rooney, if Leo belongs in the Hall of Fame, and he said, like, 100%, he should be. And because he heard the stories from Art, he knew Leo would go down and visit Art in the hospital when he was sick, when he was old. Leo did so, literally, he spent his life going behind the scenes constantly. So, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I just want to say for those, and I'm going to say this so people have to buy the book, but your story about the men with the cigars and the hats and the cigars when you were a little boy, I want to leave that for people. You got to get the book to be able to find out that story.
It's a good story.
Harry Houdini too. Everybody, I love the Harry Houdini reference.
There you go. Boris Gump. There you go.
Right? Yep.
Guys, award-winning author Jeff Miller lives in Springville, New York, the hometown of Pop Warner. And then of course, John Stephen Hagen, the great-grandson of NFL co-founder Leo Lyons, who still lives in Rochester. If you would like to purchase the book, Amazon.com, you can search Leo Lyons, the Rochester Jeffersons, and the birth of the NFL, or go to McFarlandBooks.com. And again, you can search there, Leo Lyons, the Rochester Jeffersons, and the birth of the NFL. Guys, thanks so much for joining us, and we really appreciate the work. It's a great book, and thanks for the time, and look forward to doing it again.
Thanks, George. Thanks, so thanks John. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Had a great time.
Take care.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones, too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.